die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact threat. And that is why you are here.
And the foreknown history to the unknown future. This is Reneus Radio. For the Seeker.
I must strive to know.
Welcome, boys and girls, to another Red Ice Radio program. I'm Henrik, and we are glad to have you with us today. We cover many different areas and topics that would be defined as being on the fringes by some, but I'd like to say that they are among some of the most interesting and important. Red Ice Creations. .com and redicemembers.com is our websites. And you don't have to agree with all our guests to appreciate some of their knowledge. The point is that we talk about different theories and thoughts, research and ideas that both can reaffirm and challenge our beliefs and what we think we know. Today we're spending about an hour with geologist Scott Volter. He has authored 8 books and has been president of American Petrographic Services since 1990. And is responsible for the independent petrographic analysis testing laboratory where the Kensington runestone was brought for investigation in 2000. He has been the principal petrographer in more than 5,000 investigations throughout the US and around the world. His latest book is called The Hooked X, Key to the Secret History of North America, and he currently is involved in the television series America Unearthed on History Channel. He joins us for an update on the Kensington runestone, the hidden history of America, and primarily what the implications of the Kensington runestone is, and where the evidence that Scott has found most recently has taken him, and what his conclusions are at this point. Welcome, Scott. It's been quite a few years since you were with us last time, and of course you've expanded on your work, you've moved into new areas, and these days, so I think people will probably know you most for the new America Unearthed series running on H2 or History Channel number 2 there. So it's good to have you back, Scott. Thank you again for coming on with us here.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Henrik, and it's nice to talk to you again.
Excellent. I want to talk more about your series here, of course, some of the episodes and the subjects that you address, but to kind of set the stage a little bit for our audience to know where you're coming from, I think it would be good to start talking a little bit about the Kensington runestone and the Hooked
right.
X, you know, obviously since so much of your work on the mysteries of the past of ancient America kind of is hinged around this. So what should people know about the Kensington runestone and the Hooked X?
Okay. Well, you know, the whole thing started for me back in July of 2000 when I was asked to perform a forensic study on the Kensington runestone, which at the time I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. And, you know, they were pretty excited about it. But, you know, I get a lot of interesting projects. And when I started it, I really wasn't all that, you know, concerned about it or that impressed, and I just did my work. And then when I finished and presented the findings, you know, I thought that people would be happy. I thought to myself, well, they got one, good for them. And quite frankly, I was ready to move on, you know, and get done with this because it was a long project. And when I presented my findings, there were many people who questioned me, criticized me, and then attacked me, and
yep.
And I didn't take that too well. So anyway, that's what launched me into this further investigation. But The stone was found in 1898 by a Swedish immigrant farmer named Olof Åhman, who was clearing trees on his land in western Minnesota, and he tipped over this 25 to 30 year old aspen tree, and tightly wrapped in the roots of that tree was this 202-pound stone with a long inscription carved in runes, hence the name Runestone. Although I think people in Sweden probably know what that is. I'm used to explaining that over here in America, because sure, we don't have them dotting the countryside like you do.
Well, but you know, let me not to cut you off there, but it's an increasingly disappearing knowledge, let me tell you, because so much of it is actually actively being suppressed. But we'll get to that later, Scott.
Yep,
please go ahead.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Yep. Anyway, you know, back in 1898, it was looked at by some scholars. And, you know, looking back now, understanding what I do now, I realized that these people didn't have a chance of figuring out what the runestone was. I mean, they saw many characters that they were able to understand, and words that and phrases they were able to decipher. But there's so much more going on within the inscription that they really had no chance at that time. And quite frankly, I don't think any of the runologists living today understand what they're dealing with either. And what I see is people that have a knowledge base. And I'm talking about, you know, people like Henrik Williams, who's a very bright guy, certainly knows things about runes. But the knowledge base that he has and others have is set. And I think what happens is that they take a look at the runestone, they say, okay, this is what I know. This is a runestone, so it must fit into this box of knowledge that I have.
Yeah.
And right at the start, they're off on the wrong foot, because that's not the way you do a scientific investigation. And I hear them use this word all the time. A scientific investigation is no preconceived ideas. You can obviously have a knowledge base, but you look at this thing with blinders on, and you just start to record data or information and let the artifact, or the inscription in this case, tell you what it is. And that's really the fundamental problem with the investigations of the past. They didn't follow proper scientific method. And that's really what I came to realize as I started to research the researchers, because I wanted to understand how come they're not seeing what I see, what to me is obvious. So that's really one of the things that I concluded. So, you know, we looked at the runestone, we found layers of information within it, not just the inscription that everybody sees. There are punch marks, there are short strokes, there are things that were added to the inscription after the carver carved the main text. And these are codes, they are secondary messages and layers to this thing that if you're strictly looking at it in a sense of the Scandinavian runestones that you guys are, you know, so familiar with, you know, you're going to struggle, because that's not what this is. The context is completely different. The timing is different. We're talking about a medieval inscription. Why they keep talking about Vikings and the Kensington runestone, I never understood that. But it's been bungled, and you know, they just never got it right, because by and large they didn't follow proper scientific method.
Tell us, Scott, what you discovered obviously on the stone, and what method you used to decipher it, pretty much.
Well, you know, as far as the language goes, that's not something that I'm an expert in. I learned an awful lot from my co-author, Dick Nielsen, and I learned a lot from Henrik Williams and others, Michael Barnes, Professor Michael Barnes in the British Isles, and others who taught me enough to be extremely dangerous, but obviously I'm not an expert. And so I understand the text a little bit, but for me, being a geologist, it's the physical aspects of the stone, it's the chemical aspects of the minerals inside the stone, the weathering, the calcite, all this stuff that, you know, is my forte. And so I have a very good grasp of the geological aspects of the stone and the weathering. But, you know, I'm not the first geologist to look at the stone. The first geologist to look at the Kensington runestone was a guy by the name of Professor Newton Winchell, who was the first state geologist of Minnesota and is a giant in my field. I mean, I learned about Winchell when I was my first year in college. But I didn't know anything about his work on the Kensington runestone until after I had reached my own conclusion. And when I found out that he had studied the runestone, I got nervous. I thought, oh my God, what if he has a different conclusion? Well, he didn't. And in fact, when I did finally read his work, he did an amazing job. And he did a relative age weathering study similar to what I did. It was different, but he chose to go down the same path of doing a comparative weathering study. And in the end, he concluded that the weathering was old and that the stone was genuine. Of course, I was pretty happy to hear this when I finally realized we did come to the same conclusion. But you know what, Henrik? I really shouldn't have been nervous because, you know, that's how science works. It has to be reproducible. So really, you know, there's a lot of people that are saying, wow, you solved the Kensington runestone. And I say, no, I didn't. Newton Winchell did it 90 years before I did, and he didn't have the fancy equipment that I did, the scanning electron microscopes and X-ray diffraction, infrared spectrometry, and so on, but yet he came to the same conclusion. And it's interesting that here we are, two hard science people that are practicing in geology, and we stand alone in contrast to people in archaeology, anthropology, history, language, linguistics, all wonderful disciplines, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to them because they're wonderful fields. But the fact of the matter is they don't receive formal training in the scientific method, and it shows. And I think that's really the fundamental difference between why myself and Newton Winchell and other geologists that have reviewed my work say that the stone is old, and then logic tells you it has to be genuine. And what that means, okay, what that means is if the stone is genuine, then everything in that inscription must also be genuine. In other words, everything in that inscription has to be consistent with the 14th century. And again, this is a simple deductive logic. And what I would say to the academics is, you guys are missing out on one of the most incredible opportunities of your life. I mean, for somebody like Henrik Williams, here's the first, you know, runestone found in this country that's absolutely genuine. It's a long text. It's got all kinds of things that you can learn from.
Yeah.
And others can learn from, but yet they've treated it like a piece of crap for over 100 years. And it's just
they
beyond disappointing.
It's fake. They assume it's fake just because it's just not possible in according to what they've learned so far, right? That's
well, guess what? I think all of us, as we go through our lives, realize as we get older, there's more and more that we don't know, even though we continue to acquire knowledge. And I think that attitude has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing story. Why don't we just talk a little bit about what is contained on the stone, of course, and what it points to for those who don't know, Scott?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you the latest translation, and I'm sure it's going to change as it has throughout time. But the basic message is pretty much the same. And it says eight Goths and 22 Norman, which some people have translated as Norwegians. And I'm beginning to wonder if it is Norman, in fact. But eight Goths and 22 Norman on this acquisition business or taking up land far to the west of Vinland. We had camped near two shelters, one day's journey north from the stone. We were fishing one day. When we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death, and then three Latin letters, AVM, and then the last line says, save from evils. On the split side of the stone that was cleaved off before the inscription was carved from a much larger stone, it says, there are 10 men by the sea with our ships, 14 days journey from this island, year 1362. And, you know, Henrik, there is one little quick story I'd like to tell your listeners.
Sure.
To give additional context to the issue that the runologists have had. For over 100 years, the chief piece of linguistic evidence against the runestone was the first word on the split side, H-A-R in runes, Har, have 10 men by the sea with our ships. And unfortunately, that is a modern Swedish word.
Yeah, sure is.
And they beat the stone up for 100 years with that being their crown jewel. When I did my photo study of the runestone in 2002, at that time, I knew nothing about runes, okay? And all I did was document the physical characters, every one of them. I took 650 photographs under high-angle and low-angle reflected light. And I found all kinds of things that people had never seen before because nobody had ever looked carefully because it was a fake, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to waste time on a fake?
Yeah.
But I knew it was real, and I knew that it had to be looked at carefully, and before any linguist can tell us what it says, you have to know what's there. And I found all these weird punch marks and short strokes, and I also found two dots above the A in the word har that had never been seen before. I didn't know what the hell they were, and I sure as heck didn't know what they meant. But I remember people going, wait a minute, are you sure? I said, well, look at them. There they are. And sure enough, they were there. But guess what that did? That changed the word har to hair. There are 10 men by the sea with our ships, and guess what? That's an old Swedish word. So suddenly the most powerful piece of evidence against the stone is gone.
Mm.
Now, I'm not surprised by this, okay? I didn't know what I'd found. I didn't know what it was. I just said, there's two dots there. Just look at them. There they are. Mm. They're clearly man-made. And they're umlauts. But this just goes to show, and giving the early linguists credit, when they first looked at it, it had just been pulled out of the ground. It was probably still filled with mud. And those in that split side has a rougher texture than the face side where the first nine lines are because of the foliation in the rock. It's a geologic aspect of the rock that makes that surface rougher and harder to see those dots.
Mm-hmm.
So, all this can be explained through logic. And what I don't understand is why people aren't acknowledging this.
I know. Well, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, Vinland, which is mentioned on the stone, is real. We know that. The Vikings were in North America way before our buddy Chris Columbus was there. So this is a scientifically accepted fact to this day. And so why not the continuation? Why not the possibility that they went further from that place?
Well, there's a couple points here. One is what academia wants us to believe today is that the Norse were here. The Vikings were here in the year 1000. And then they want us to believe that nothing happened for 500 years until Chris came over?
Yeah.
I mean, does that even pass the smell test?
Not in my book, no.
Not in my book. I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? And obviously I've gone down the road to figure out who these people were and why they came over here. And the fundamental thing that's obvious is that these people went to great lengths to keep their activities secret, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you stop and think about it, it's an oversimplification, but I think it's apropos. If you've got a great hunting spot or fishing spot, are you going to tell anybody?
Well, depends also on the climate back home and what kind of, what is going on in the current
country.
Because we have Christianity moving in at the same time here, and there's a lot of conflict going on in the country. So maybe they're actually fleeing from something.
Exactly, and they don't want people to know where they are.
No, that's right.
And so you've got plenty of explanations that make sense. And why these people have no interest in exploring this leads me to believe that there's more going on than just stupidity. And quite frankly, Henrik, I don't think these people are that stupid. I know they're not that stupid. So why are they acting this way?
So an active cover-up, a denial of the evidence, trying to hide it and just explain it away as a hoax.
I think some of that is going on. Now, people are going to call me a conspiracy theorist, but I can tell you in my own mind, I think I understand what part of the reason is. Part of it has to do with politics,
yeah,
and part of it has to do with religion. Because the guys that came over here were fugitive Knights Templar. And the Knights Templar, as you know, in 1307, only 50 years, less than, or just over 50 years from when the Templars were put down, then we have 1362. These guys, their true ideology, which I think is symbolized by the Hooked X, had every reason to come over here. They certainly had the resources, they had the ships, they had the motivation, and they had the knowledge. And, you know, they were, you know, they were being persecuted.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people are persecuted, they're going to go to great lengths to survive, aren't they?
Oh, definitely, for sure. Before we proceed here, tell us a little bit more about the Hooked X and the implications of this, what this means. This is your follow-up book to the Kensington Runestone that you wrote, of course. So.
Yeah, and I have a new book coming out in about a month, which is also a Hooked X book. It's a continuation of that, but it's called Akhenaten to the Founding Fathers, The Mysteries of the Hooked X.
Mm.
And this ideology goes all the way back to Egypt. And I think people are going to be shocked when they read what I've written in my new book, which is a continuation of the old book. But I think they're also going to go, this makes sense. But just going back, I mean, one of the mysterious characters on the runestone is this Hooked X. And it's actually being used for the A sound, or A, within the inscription. But it's not the typical A rune that you see in Scandinavia, or the variations of it, either Viking or medieval. So what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the things the scholars did, which was ridiculous, is say, oh, well, we've never seen this before, so it must be fake. I don't know where they get that logic, but that's what many of them concluded.
Mm.
No, you simply don't understand it. How about doing a little research and figure it out?
That's right.
But, you know, we don't want to do that. Anyway, it occurs 22 times in the inscription. It's the most often used character, and nobody knows what it is. Well, one of the things that that I did, and actually I did this with my co-author Dick Nielsen back before we had a breakup. we looked at where do these runes, this language, these runes, these dialect, the grammar, the dating that we found in the stone, where does this occur? And we found many sources, or Dick found most of these sources, in documents and diplomas, medieval diplomas, that led us to the island of Gotland. Now, the other thing that you have to keep in mind is that back in the 14th century, the only people who would have been capable of carving an inscription of that complexity and length would have been a member of the clergy. Well, on Gotland at this time, you only had one clergy, the Cistercians.
That's right.
And so, you know, of course, the next thing you say, well, who the hell are they? Well, then we started looking into them. Oh, the White Monks, they were founded by Robert Molesme, 1098. Oh, they were the ones that preached the First Crusade. They're the ones that wrote the charter for the Knights Templar. Well, who are they? And you just follow the evidence trail, and it takes you there.
Yeah.
So that's how we got going on the Knights Templar, and then they started reading about the Knights Templar, and, you know, you read the academic stuff, and they paint them out to be good Roman Christians. But then you read some of the Masonic material and some of the esoteric material, and you find out, well, the leadership actually had a different agenda, different beliefs. And in fact, I believe that the Cistercians and the Knights Templar initiated the greatest plan of subterfuge in the history of the world. And some would argue they almost pulled it off. I would argue that they finished the job.
Hmm.
But the point is that that's the reason that they were put down, is because they were basically attacking the church from within. And once the church and the King of France figured it out, they nipped it in the bud just in time. So ultimately, they turned their operations to North America secretly.
So I want to talk a little bit more, obviously, about Gotland and some of the other places here where they were hanging out and you know, why they left and all that. But
the Hooked X?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just go there. So what is the Hooked X? Okay, so I started looking for the Hooked X associated with the Cistercians and the Knights Templar. And the first piece of evidence that we found, which was brought to my attention by another researcher who was following our work, was a manuscript from the 15th century, a Cistercian manuscript, where they used the character X for the letter A. It didn't have a hook on it, but it was the letter X. And I can remember hearing Henrik Williams tell me one day, shortly before that happened, he said, "The X symbol for A has never been seen in a medieval runic inscription. I don't believe it existed, and I don't think you'll ever find it."
Hmm.
And within 6 months, there it was, in a Cistercian manuscript in Germany.
Interesting.
Along with five other of the characters that are found on the Kensington runestone.
So we have correlation, in other words, on the letters here.
Well, let's put it this way. There's a lot more smoke, isn't there?
Sure.
What I call Cistercian smoke, and where there's smoke, there's fire. And what I see here in these threads throughout the research that I've done, the common denominator is the Cistercians and the Knights Templar. And eventually, of course, we found the Hooked X at Roslyn Chapel. We found the Hooked X in Masonic papers. It recently was found in the Copiel cipher. I've seen it in some other sources I can't talk about right now. And funny, the Masonic Knights Templar Grand Master incorporates the Hooked X into his sigla.
Hmm.
So there's a lot more going on here, and I can tell you that there have been many people in the Masonic world that have pulled me aside and whispered in my ear. Now, I'm on to something. And so the Hooked X, what is the Hooked X? Well, that's when I started to read about symbolism, because if it's not found in the runic record, there has to be an explanation for it, right?
Yeah.
And so I looked at the at symbolism, and if you take an X and you chop it in half, you get the Da Vinci Code. You know, the peak is the sword, the phallic, the penis, the symbol for the male. You turn it around 180 degrees, you have the vessel, the chalice, the womb, the symbol for the female. When you combine them together, you make an X. You have the allegorical union of male and female, heaven and earth, good, bad, light, dark, yin-yang, the whole concept of dualism, which is the concept of opposites that keep things in balance. This is what the Cistercians and the Templars leadership embraced. That was the true ideology, a single deity with dualism. And this goes back to Egypt. That's where it came from. This is what the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten was teaching. And that's why he was persecuted and eventually driven out, which was probably the Exodus, the biblical Exodus. But many scholars are starting to look down this road, and I think they're right. But the whole point is that their faith was symbolized by this character. And that's what it was, essentially monotheistic dualism. And of course, the Roman Church was teaching a patriarchal, male-dominated faith. And that was something that they were not comfortable with. And so hence the war, ideological war. But then you still have to explain the hook. And I explain that in a couple of ways. If you look at it, it creates another little V in the upper right arm, correct?
Yep.
Which is symbolic of a child, in this case, a daughter, inside the womb, inside the big V of its mother. Some people have suggested, and I think they're right, that it also symbolized the belief of the Cistercians and the Knights Templar in Jesus being the peak, Mary Magdalene, his wife and queen, being the vessel on the top, and that she was pregnant at the time of the crucifixion with a daughter whose name was Sarah.
Hmm.
And who would know that? The family would know it, the descendants would know it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And many people believe, as I do, that the Cistercians and the Knights Templar leadership, and I want to emphasize the leadership, people like St. Bernard de Clairvaux, I believe were the bloodline descendants of Jesus and Mary. And that symbol represents their attempt to bring that belief system back into power. And that's pretty controversial. That's pretty heavy-hitting stuff. But if you stop and think about it, if we're right about this, this would explain this big picture controversy I was talking about earlier, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Tell us now the, and I want to, you know, do much more to discuss there, of course, some of the details of this, but the why you think it is that they kept the runic script here, if we're ultimately talking about, you know, Templars and everything else.
Right,
certainly
right.
These could just be
sure
Norse people, but yeah, go ahead.
It's a good question. And the answer to that is, well, I don't know for sure, but I can speculate. What many people don't realize is that the Cistercians and the Knights Templar were a multi-ethnic organization, okay? Once you took a vow and entered the order, they didn't care if you were German, if you were French, if you were Irish, if you were English, you were Swedish, no, they don't care, okay? Once you become a brother, it doesn't matter. And they had monasteries, they had 750 monasteries in the early part of the 14th century, just before the put-down, all through the Holy Land, Europe, in through Scandinavia. They were everywhere, okay?
Yep.
So the point is, the reason runes were used, to me, logic says it had to be a Cistercian monk, most likely, traveling with the Templars, who was of Swedish education, probably from the island of Gotland, or maybe over by Uland, Sweden, just on the eastern coastline there, southeastern
yep.
coastline,
yep.
because that's where we found the linguistic evidence. So all it means is the person who carved that used runes because in that language because that's where he was from. But that's fine. It doesn't matter.
That's right. The island Gotland that you talked about, this is also where basically the Hanseatic League had their high nest in this. It's the largest island in the Baltic Sea. And there was actually a trading post. A lot of different, cultures were going from
exactly.
there, from Germany, Estonia, Sweden, Finland, you have it, you name it, basically.
No question about it. So, you know, I think what happens is people are so quick, you know, they're so firmly entrenched in their belief, and I emphasize the word belief, that the runestone is a hoax or a fraud, that they don't stop to think it through. They just quickly answer and say, well, that's they couldn't have carved that. Why would they use runes? Well, they use runes for a couple of reasons. One, I'm convinced that the carver, that was the language that he would use. And the reason they carved in runes is because they're basically, the characters are made of straight lines and they lend themselves to carving in stone.
Yeah. Yeah,
isn't that the reason? Part of the reason they go back as far as they do. I mean, curved lines are hard to carve in stone, and believe me, I know. I've carved my own runestone. So
the Romans knew that too. That's why the U's look like V's. You know, so
exactly. So, I mean, you know, if you stop and you think it through, it makes a lot of sense. You know, and the facts support all this.
Okay, so let's get into the deep kind of political end of this. Why this is so heavily suppressed. Is there an undercurrent here of this knowledge being actively maybe sought after, but officially denied? What do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly what's going on. And you got two problems. One, the religious problem of the Roman Church. But, I mean, let's face it, Henrik, the Roman Church is struggling right now, and they did it to themselves. You know, and it's too bad, but you know, I think that there's no question that the church has had free reign of the world for a long time. But in my opinion, it's not a sustainable institution. The ideology of a patriarchal, male-dominated society just isn't going to work long term. I think we all have seen that. I think we all understand that. And I think this restoration of balance is necessary for our very survival as a species, quite frankly. And I think if you stop and look at it, over the past 40, 50 years, women in our country, for sure, have made tremendous strides for equality. And if you go back in history, that's the way it was. And in fact, if anything, in most ancient cultures, women were elevated above the male for the simple reason that they're the life givers. And that's the faith that we're talking about that the Cistercians and the Templar leadership embraced. And I think that's what Jesus was really teaching. And I think that that's, and he was a powerful man. He was an important man. And that's what the Romans were worried about. And that's why I think he was attacked and he lost. And that's why this whole political thing or religious thing got tipped out of balance. But politics go hand in hand with religion, as you know.
Oh, sure.
But here's the other conundrum with the runestone. It's a land claim. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It's placed at the headwaters of the Mississippi-Missouri watershed and the Red River-Hudson Bay watershed to the north. Okay,
mm-hmm.
There's a tradition of land claim practices by the French in the 14th century. Funny, where were the Cistercians and the Templars founded? In France.
Yep.
They had a tradition if you could prove that you navigated to the headwaters of a river system, you could and place proof like a runestone. Making the claim, you could lay claim to the entire river system and all the land associated with it. Well, the fact is at Kensington, theoretically, you could lay claim to the entire Mississippi-Missouri watershed to the south and the Red River-Hudson Bay watershed to the north. That's about half the continent over here. Why am I the first person to bring this up? People say, well, why would they go all the way there? Did you ever stop to think that maybe logic will tell you they did it for a reason? Start using your heads. And I mean, seriously, it's like, look, there's no magic going on here with me. I'm just a rockhead for crying out loud. And I mean, I had a lot of help from other people, but you know, we put this together pretty quick with logic, of course. And so if it's a land claim, what does that say about the ownership of this continent or of our country? I mean, I don't know if anybody would ever make a serious claim. I don't know how they could and who would do it. Because it doesn't make a claim to any king in honor of any queen or any nation. Although the Hooked X is emblazoned all over that stone. And at that time, the Knights Templar were a sovereign nation. They were beholden to no one. They were basically outlaws, right?
Well, I wanted to ask you about this and see what you know about this history, because obviously, as we know, the Templars, they begin as crusaders for the Pope. The first crusade, 1096 to 99, was actually for Pope Urban II. So this is
That's what they wanted them to think.
Okay, so it's not. Are you saying it's not from the Roman Church and the Pope that this began?
Well, let's no, it's not that simple. Let me give you an analogy, okay?
Yeah.
And I'll use our American military because that's what I'm comfortable with. But let me ask you a simple question. Do you think the guys fighting on the front lines have the same information as the guys running the show, the generals?
Of course not.
So the bulk of the Templars that were fighting for Christianity, that fought the Crusades, were fighting for the church. But there was ulterior motives going on at the same time. Now, if I'm right that Bernard and other leaders of the Cistercian and Templar orders in the early part of the 12th century were in fact members of the bloodline of Jesus. Let's just use that term because people are going to get upset about it, but that's what I think they were.
Mm-hmm.
In their minds, they were going back to Jerusalem to secure the perimeter, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that they could go back underneath the temple and get the stuff that they knew was there. Not only that, I think they went into... Are you familiar with the Talpiot tomb?
No, I don't recognize it. Tell us about that.
Look it up. In 1980, it was discovered in southern Jerusalem in the East Talpiot neighborhood. There was a first century tomb found there with 10 ossuaries, 6 of them inscribed with names.
Ah, it's the one with this famous symbol on it that we recognize, famous symbol.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep. Yep.
Pyramid with a little circle in it.
My symbol, which was an amazing discovery for me. When I realized that, I went, holy crap. But it didn't shock me because I knew that he was part of the whole process. But anyway, the point is that somebody, according to the scholars, said somebody entered that tomb 900 years ago. Funny, what was going on 900 years ago? Oh, the First Crusades. Who fought those? Oh, the Knights Templar. And what did I just tell you? That the leadership was probably part of the bloodline. And what they went in... Now, here are the facts of the Talpiot tomb. of those 10 ossuaries, two of them, the ossuaries were empty. No bones in them. The rest had bones. These are facts, okay? Guess which two?
Don't know.
Jesus, son of Joseph. Mariamne Mara. Mariamne Mara. Mariamne is a pet name for Mary Magdalene that's used in the first gospel of Philip. Mara is a title of honor. And her ossuary is beautifully decorated with rosettes and the flower of life. And hers is the only name that's carved in Greek. To be buried in a first century ossuary, you have to be a wealthy family. And to have an ornately carved ossuary, you have to be rich. So, hence this conundrum. So now the bones are missing. But whoever went into that tomb 900 years ago left three skulls placed in a triangle as reverence, because these people entered their own family tomb. This was the tomb of their ancestors, of their king. And all they took were his and hers bones. Now, why would they do that? The answer is obvious. As protection against the church. Because if the church leadership, and eventually they did figure it out. I mean, basically they had those bones that said, hey, don't you mess with us. Because the very foundation of the Roman church is the divinity of Jesus, right?
Mm.
Well, to have bones of that would be a problem, wouldn't it? So that's the facts, and that's exactly what happened. Now, the triangle symbol is very interesting. If you study the Templars, if you study the Freemasons, it's an ancient symbol, which is basically the downward pointing triangle is the pubic triangle. Here again, the symbol where life comes from. And this ancient reverence of the sacred feminine, which is the essence of their ideological beliefs. And this is the war, this ideological war that's been raging ever since. And that's the reason that they came over here, so they could practice their faith without persecution. And what's interesting is that most Native American cultures on this continent are matriarchal. And one of the things that I've done a few years ago is I figured, I used logic again. If these people came over here, who do you think they ran into?
Well, the Native American Indians, of course.
Of course. Maybe they know something. Oh, that's right. We had a little problem over here with the natives. It was called genocide.
Yep.
And so the natives haven't exactly been interested in talking to white people. But you know what I did is I reached out to them, and I just did two simple things. One, respect their culture. And two, listen. And I'll tell you what, they got a lot to say. And I'll just sum it up by saying one thing to you, Henrik. They know.
Okay.
They know.
Hmm.
So there you go.
Well, we know that there was a lot of course, intermarrying between tribes and some of the first people that came over. And I've
no
heard this,
question about it.
Yeah, I've heard this before as well. This theory that we had a second persecution, if you will, that was extended over here for that very reason. Because for maybe a few hundred years, even there might have been an established, you know, culture at that stage in North America. And the Roman Church wanted to get over there later on to try to eradicate these people, potentially. I don't know. It's an interesting.
Well, no, you hit the nail right on the head. In fact, what I've been told is that there was a war that raged here for 250 years before contact. The church was sending over Jesuit spies to try to eradicate the Templars who had intermarried with the native people over here. And they shared rituals. Because they shared basically the same ideology. And it's a fascinating story. I fleshed this out in great detail. It's supported by numerous facts. And I think it's gonna shock the world, quite frankly, because if you stop and think about it, everything I've told you, as unorthodox as it seems, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a trail that that just doesn't go away. It there's so much that keeps pointing back to that again and again. And a lot of researchers that are beginning in one end, they come to very similar conclusions, I believe. So yeah, there's something there, I think.
There's something going on. And you know, another thing that I can tell you, and I report these in my new book, I've looked at a lot of artifacts and I've seen a lot of fakes too. I know, believe me, I don't make it up for anybody, okay? I love the fact the runestone's real, but if it wasn't, I would have said it right away.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I'm the first person ever to document without question that one of the Burroughs cave artifacts is a fake. And, you know, this just goes to show you how stupid I am. I spent about $20,000 buying Burroughs cave artifacts so I could test them without worrying about taking invasive samples and wrecking somebody else's artifact.
Hey, which one? We did a show on Burroughs Caves recently. Which one have you found is a fake?
It was one of the white marble pieces. It's the Isis stone.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely fake. And when you read my report, it's obvious.
I want to see
now,
that, yeah.
Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that all the artifacts are fake. And
sure.
It doesn't mean that there isn't a cave. It's an open question, but it casts a long shadow over all of them and certainly on the authenticity of the cave. I don't know if the cave is real. I don't know about the 5,000 or so other artifacts, if they're real or not, but I can tell you absolutely for sure that one is fake, and I can prove it, and nobody will argue with me, including Russell Burroughs.
Yeah.
Because Russ was the first guy I called. But my point is this. Is that when we do the forensic work, when I render an opinion, I do it only because I feel I have generated enough factual evidence to support what I say to the point where I could testify in a court of law under oath, because that's the standard that I have to meet as a licensed professional in my field. But yet academics treat me like I'm some kind of a clown. And I would ask you this question. If I do something stupid and unethical, I could lose my job and potentially I could go to jail. Okay?
Mm.
What accountability does a tenured professor have?
A lot of accountability.
Not in our country.
Oh, really?
They're basically autonomous. They don't have to answer to anybody.
Oh, is that how
Except
it works? Yeah, okay. I see what you're getting at. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
No, it's true. I mean, it's a fact. I mean, you know, again, I appreciate that, but it's the way it is. But the point is that here I am getting attacked by people that aren't held to the same standard I am, and I have to listen to this garbage from these clowns?
Well, you're the pseudoscientists. You're the ones that have to be questioned. I read a lot about this online, of course. It's kind of funny following this debate. But it seems to be the main crux of the thing is of course, you know, try to discredit, first of all, as much as possible.
Yeah.
Look at your past, what have you. But at that point, it's not really about maybe looking at the evidence presented at hand and also the things that, you know, you've really been looking into and the things that you're suggesting. It's other circumstantial things in most cases.
Well, Henrik, believe me, I understand the difference between fact and speculation, okay?
Yeah.
I get that. And I make it very clear when I'm giving my lectures or when I write my books or write my papers, where is the fact and where is the speculation?
Sure, yeah.
But
yeah.
What these clowns want to do is they want to take the speculation, mix in the facts, and try to dismiss it all as speculation. And that's just blatantly dishonest. It certainly isn't scientific, and I don't know why people listen to them or take them seriously, but, you know, that's the culture we live in, I guess, in this world. And it's really not so much, I don't think, anymore, you know, a Swedish thing or an American thing or whatever. I mean, with the advances technologically of the Internet and instant communication, you know, for a long time you could play that game and you could put people down. But with the instant transfer of information, things are happening so fast, this stuff is all going to crumble. And if there's one thing I've learned in my business, and it's not just the artifacts, it's the concrete, it's the rock, it's everything I've been doing in the forensic world, the truth eventually bubbles to the surface every time.
I hope you're right.
It will. I guarantee it will. Because here's the thing. I challenge anybody who thinks the Runestone's not genuine. Let's have a mock trial, okay? And I'll put together my arguments, my facts, and you put together yours. And then let's hash it out in front of a jury of our peers. And I'll tell you what will happen, Henrik. They won't show up. They haven't shown up. This isn't the first time I've issued this challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why they won't show up. Because they don't understand forensics. They don't understand logic. And they don't understand facts. And here's what I mean. If the Runestone's genuine, okay, that is supported, and that genuine conclusion is supported by facts in geology, in language, in runes, dialect, grammar, history, modern history, ancient history, Templar history, whatever you want to talk about that I have proposed and others have proposed. If it's real and those facts are there, then how in the hell can there be factual evidence to support the contrary?
Yeah, it's a big conundrum. By definition,
it can't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I'll tell you, this is a fact. I'm still waiting for the first piece of factual evidence that supports the Runestone being a hoax.
Mm-hmm. Is it just on face value of these other scientists who inspected it that we should perceive that it's a fake? Or what are some of the arguments that they're using?
Well, Haar was one of them. Now, in fairness to them, they didn't know about the two dots and they had a modern Swedish word. Well, it turns out the dots were there. So linguistically, you know, and the questions that many of these linguists have, which is fair, that's fine to have questions because you're dealing with an immensely complicated document. And, you know, the answer is you've got a real artifact. You just got to find the evidence because it has to exist. That's what I said in the very beginning, and we went out and found 99% of it because I knew it had to be out there. So they need to change their attitude, and they need to think more like a scientist. But it's hard for them because they don't truly understand the process. And I know they get all pissed off because, well, we understand it. Well, no, you don't. Because if you did, you would operate differently. And you wouldn't have ended up with the conclusion that you did. And here's one other thought in that vein to all these opponents out there. It's okay to say this. I don't know. Because you better not open your mouth unless you have the evidence to support what you say and, you know, to the point where you can draw a reasonable conclusion that you can testify to in a court of law, because that's a standard. And if you can't do that, then you have to say, I don't know. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you're dumb, okay? It means you're smart. Because I say it all the time. If I don't have enough evidence, I'll say, I don't know. But when I have the evidence and I say it, I'm willing to testify to it.
Well,
that's the way it should be.
That's the way it should be. That's right. And just the idea as well that we said this before on the program, we don't have a time machine yet, so we can't actually go back and see all the exact details of what happened, you know, 1,500 years ago or 5,000 years ago or even 200 years ago. There's a lot of things that are unknown in this process of history and figuring out what it's wrong, but just because it's like the perceived reality or the collective consensus doesn't mean that it's right. That's history itself has proven that to be wrong. A lot of people who have made discoveries, etc., that stand alone on their own with the whole academic community against them. Later on, they're, you know, not all, of course, but some of them are proven right because they had a theory that challenged things. So
that's right.
I think we should be a little bit more, humble in terms of how we choose to attack each other about what's truth and not, because we don't know at this stage. We're speculating a lot, but we're trying to figure it out, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, and beyond that, what I would like to see is interdisciplinary communication. I think we should be working together.
That's right.
I mean, I just assumed, if you stop and think about it, archaeologists are digging stuff out of the ground, right? and they're working with stone artifacts, lithic artifacts. I mean, who would, what discipline you would think would be the first one that they would lean on? Geology.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. And I just assumed early on that there was this communication. Boy, was I wrong. And I was really disappointed to see that. And in fact, it's not just, it's adversarial in many cases. And, you know, let me ask you this, Scott.
If you believe, obviously, and I believe you're right when it comes to the compartmentalization of these different fields and such.
Yep.
But interestingly enough, someone, I think, the universities, these overseers of universities, what have you, that actually where a lot of this data is collected, they do have the capability of maybe piecing some of these stuff together for themselves by just collecting the individual work that has been done. Do you think that someone has the, you know, a general idea that it's in somewhat the similar vein of what you've just, talked about in conclusion in terms of what happened?
Do I think there are other people that are finding what I'm finding?
That's right, who maybe even be higher up in the academic world, if you will.
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. I don't know if they're as far down the track as I am or as vocal as I am, but I think there are other people out there that are finding these things. I mean, I guarantee you if they look, they will find them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're there. There's no question.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you about some of the items around, I mean, as you're doing your series, and there's a lot of different components, obviously, to your work that are building this picture more and more. Are there other fundamental aspects or quote-unquote mysteries that we don't, know that much about right now, but actually are contributing to this whole picture? There's a couple of things that came up in your series, I think, that actually adds on to this, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole bunch of stuff.
A Newberry tablet, a lot of stuff, yeah.
Well, to me, one of the most fascinating artifacts that absolutely blew my mind, that I had the amazing opportunity to examine three different times, is the Tucson lead artifacts that were found buried under 6 feet, up to 6 feet, between 4 and 6 feet, of caliche cemented alluvial sand and gravel. I mean, geologically, this site is pristine. The context, the veracity of the digs was perfect. They were all documented, photographed. They invited academics to come in and do the digs. And amazingly, there were a few of the academics that actually dug the artifacts out who said, well, nobody planted these things. They absolutely are in context, but I don't believe they're real. What the hell is that?
Yeah, what is that?
but they're amazing.
It's too shocking, so it can't be real, right?
Well, but if you think about it in the context of the story I laid out earlier,
yeah,
they fit perfectly. And that there actually was a Roman Jewish community, because these things have both Latin and Hebrew on them, and symbology that is perfect for a Roman Jewish colony that existed in southern France. Oh, funny, we're back in that same region again, in the 8th and 9th centuries, that did use, Latin, Roman letters, and AD, and, everything fits. And a lot of people say, well, this, they didn't do this. Well, do your homework. Yes, they did. They didn't use, these are standard Latin phrases that existed back in the late 1800s. Well, if they existed in the 1800s, they existed before that, right?
Yeah,
they had to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the arguments just don't make any sense at all. But yet people have accepted them in any attempt to dismiss these artifacts and the history they represent, because the history is inconvenient. I don't have to explain history to you. I mean, if you suddenly just change the paradigm and turn it on its head, people have said to me, well, gee, that means you have to rewrite the history books. Well, then rewrite them. Just do it. What's the problem?
Well, you'd think that that's the idea. But again, as you've alluded to before, there's politics behind history. There is a reason why I think, we're not allowed to know the full story,
Exactly. Exactly. And for me, that I work in this world that is pretty straightforward, and everything is, chain of custody and, factual evidence and interpretations and conclusions. And I just don't think people appreciate how stringent and rigid that world is that I come from. And yet I get looked down you know, the nose of academics who look at me as somehow, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. And it's like, okay, I mean, you know, I mean, the government assigned me to work on the Pentagon after the 9/11 attack.
That's right. I remember that. We talked about that last time. Yeah. Interesting stuff there, by the way. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's amazing stuff. And I mean, you know, catastrophic failures and some of the most sensitive stuff that happens, not just in our country, but around the world. And apparently I'm capable of handling that stuff. But, you know, I'm an idiot when it comes to looking at runestones. Suddenly I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, it's just...
I think it's, again, just because of your conclusions to some cases are just too unbelievable for a lot of people to be able to connect these dots, because I mean there are so many points here that people have like an aversion to, like even the basics of transcultural diffusion. A lot of people say no, they're impossible, there can't have been communication going on between, you know, these ancient cultures in the past, and that's where a lot of people kind of, they end it right there, you know, and then they miss out on a lot of stuff.
Well, how often have you heard the truth is stranger than fiction?
Yeah.
And, you know, just because you don't believe it doesn't mean it's not true.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, get over yourself and, you know, again, get back to the basic, you know, facts and the science and see what it tells you. And, I mean, the other big problem that we have here is what I call problems of the human condition. You know, arrogance and hubris and, you know, agendas and protecting turfs and politics and of people.
Yeah.
And they impact our lives every day more than they probably should. But that's the way the world works with the human beings. And
Scott, you know, I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, jump in. I'm babbling here. Go ahead.
It's okay. I wanted to get to some of the other aspects here, both that you deal with in the series, and I think you have a lot to say about these things. Michigan copper ending up in the Mediterranean, the Newberry tablet. There's so many different interesting aspects to this.
Yep.
You did
a
whole episode, I believe, on the copper one. Tell us about that.
Well, the copper one was a lot of fun because we have some basic facts over here that there were millions of pounds of copper that were mined out of here going back 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. And we sure can't account for it with the Native Americans. And on the other hand, we've got over in Europe during the Bronze Age, we've got millions of pounds of copper that was smelted into bronze that some people have told me. And I haven't investigated this to the level that where I can speak with authority. But I know enough here, again, to be dangerous. I mean, my understanding is the copper reserves over in Europe and North Africa can't account for all that copper. And I'm telling you, I mean, I live in copper country here, and I've been underwater. I've been collecting copper. It's the purest copper in the world. It's 99% pure copper. And, you know, the glaciers basically left it littered all over the place. I mean, we still can go out in the woods and find native copper laying around. But if you go back thousands of years ago, it was everywhere.
Mm.
And so, you know, and back at that time during the Bronze Age and before, some of the sources I've read said that copper, because of its antibacterial capabilities, its conductivity properties, its malleability, it's relatively easy to work with, that it was more valuable than gold and silver. And, you know, people just look at me and say, well, they just couldn't have got here. It's too far. What do you mean it's too far?
Boat. Go by boat.
How about a boat? And again, if you're interacting with the indigenous people, you know, the news is eventually going to get there. It obviously got there. So why wouldn't they have come over here? And maybe that is where, you know, the copper for the bronze came from. It's the largest source in the world, and it's not even close. So, and it's just laying all over the place, literally laying on the ground.
Wow. Tell us about the Newberry tablet and what that is.
The Newberry tablet is an interesting tablet that I looked at for the first time on the show. I mean, when you saw me looking at it, that was the first time I ever looked at it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I mean, some of the show, we, you know, there's a little bit of, we take a few liberties as we film, but most of the time it happens as it happens. And I'd never seen it before. It was very, very interesting. And, you know, some people say that it was crafted in the 18th century. I don't know if that language was. I've seen some pretty good sources since we did that episode that suggest the Colburn language is much older. So do I know for sure what the answer is? No, I don't. And I haven't done enough work on that to say, you know what, here's one of those times, Henrik, I don't know.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the other aspects. What do you make of, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding the aspects of giants. You did one on Minnesota, of course,
right,
but there's
right,
so much
right.
more all across America, finds and such. What do you make of it? What do you think about it?
Well, again, I don't know if I've had enough information to draw a conclusion. I can tell you that we have received hundreds of tips about giants. I have spoken with a number of Native tribes. And incidentally, I'm just going to segue off for a second, then I'll come back.
Sure.
Some of the people that have criticized me have called me racist because I have the audacity to suggest that some of the mound building cultures and some of the astronomical alignments and things that we see here on this continent, that Native Americans couldn't have done it themselves, that they had to have influence from other cultures across the oceans. And because I say that, I therefore am racist against Native Americans.
Yeah, well, that's a cheap shot, you know.
Well, it's a cheap shot, but it's a technique.
Exactly,
to get people to back off.
Yeah.
I can tell you this. I'm very close with the Eastern Band of Cherokee. The Central Band of Cherokee gave me a Cherokee name. I'm very close to those tribes. I'm very close to certain Ojibwe people and other Native cultures who have shared some very personal information, very sacred information with me. And I don't think they would call me racist. I don't think they would.
Well, whatever it is, there are legends about these, you know, white people with bearded people being over on the other side and stuff like that. I mean, this is not us making that up. It's just a mythological record. What do we can't help case.
It's part of their history. Not only did they have giants, but they also had little people too.
Mm, yeah.
So it's very interesting. And even though in the episode that we aired, you know, we weren't able to conclude anything definitively. And in fact, the way that episode went, we should have filmed the ending after I met with the state archaeologist, because the state archaeologist who went up to that dig and told me that they were it was a 5.5-foot person. I said, well, show me a picture. He showed me pictures of the women, but he didn't show me a picture of the guy.
Mm.
And I said, well, you went all the way up there. Why didn't you take a picture of him? Well, I left. I go, what do you mean you left? I left. You drove 4 hours one way up there to go see this dig. You know you're going to be interviewed on this program. You know I'm going to ask you this question, and you left?
Yeah.
Well, the state anthropologist was there. She conducted the dig.
Yeah.
Well, funny, she won't talk to me.
Yeah, well, I saw that, and I just like, wait a minute now. If there's something like this going on there, why wouldn't there be more investigations into this overall? It seems like there was a rush job, and they didn't even want to look into it further. I mean, that's a...
Well, the bottom line is that as far as the episode goes, the question was not answered.
No.
It's still an open question, and I can also tell you this, Henrik, we're going to be doing more with the giants in the future.
Yeah, because that's a big subject, actually, and there is a lot of other, you know, evidence in America specifically, and the Smithsonian have done their fair share of covering a lot of this up. And just like you did in the episode, you actually have to go back to the older newspaper coverage to see some of the real gems in terms of this, you know?
You are absolutely right, and that's where the best sources are. I mean, I could go on all day with you know, this and the cover-ups that have gone on. But I will tell you this, we will be looking into this in future episodes.
Well, that's great. So it's season two going right now, or is it what's going on there?
Yep, we leave tomorrow for Washington, D.C., and we've taken three trips so far, and we're having a blast, I tell you.
Yeah.
I have to say this too, Henrik, because I am extremely fortunate to have this opportunity. I'm not a TV person. I don't know. I must have been born with a horseshoe up my rear end or something, because I'm living a dream, and to have this opportunity to get this information out to the world is an honor and a privilege, and I take it very seriously. We're having a lot of fun, and but this is serious business too. I mean, the stuff we talked about earlier is pretty heavy stuff, and I believe that it's right. And I believe that the only way, you know, I'll be honest with you, I think as a species we're at a critical juncture. We got 7 billion people on this planet right now and growing. And I think everybody who is honest realizes we can't keep going like this.
Yeah, well, that's another issue.
If we don't do something about this population problem, nature will.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that if we're as smart as we think we are, we should be able to figure this out. And I'm not talking about, you know, one person in a family, but I think we have to be honest and realize we have to make changes. And I don't profess to have all the answers, but the one thing I do believe is that before we can go forward into the future intelligently, we have to know where we've been.
Well, that I agree with.
And we have to know the truth about where we've been.
Well,
and then I
start
think,
anyway.
Then I think, I mean, let's face it, you know, family secrets, or this is a big secret. Once it comes out, people can handle it. They can process it. And then once they have the information, then they can decide what the heck they're going to do. But if they don't have the information, they can't really make an informed decision how to go forward.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do, is just get the truth out there and then let the chips fall where they may. But I'm optimistic. I think the human race is wonderful, and I think we will figure it out. I really do.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right. I think you know, that there's so much that's hidden to us, and I think overall that we would do better as human beings if we actually did have an idea about our past and our roots and everything else. But there seems to be confusion on the agenda as number one right now, because no one is even interested in many of these things anymore. But maybe it's increasing, though. I mean, only 10 years ago, there wouldn't have been this kind of focus, I guess, even on the History Channel. They've also expanded, and a lot of these other networks are doing their bid to you know, at least peripherally begin to look at some of these things. You know what I mean? So maybe that's
right. Encouraging.
I don't know. Yeah.
No, I think it is changing, and I give History Channel and H2 a lot of credit, because I've sat down, you know, with the head of the network, and I looked him in the eye and I said, hey guys, you know, this isn't for the faint of heart. You know, I mean, we're going to be hitting people between the eyes, and we're going to hit them hard. I mean, when you start talking about people's faith, about, you know, Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene and all of this, and I mean, this is heavy stuff. And it's very disturbing to many people. And, you know, we're not trying to offend anybody. I'm not trying to. I just want to know what happened. That's where I'm coming from. And, you know, I said, look, it's all hands on deck. I mean, you're either all in or you're not. Are you guys in? And they said, we're in. So I really appreciate that support, because I'm sure there are a lot of other networks out there would say, we're not going there. And if somebody has to stand up, somebody has to say it. And what the hell? I got a big mouth. I'll say it.
Well, exactly. At least you're out there and doing it. A lot of people are comfortably just sitting at home and complaining on it all the time. So, you know, at least you're out there doing some of the work on this. Now, tell us where people can go to as we begin to round things up with this time, then, Scott, where people can go not only to pick up copies of your the two books. You have your third one as well coming out right now. Are you going to link that up through your websites that you have?
Yes, we will. My website is www.hookedx.com, and you can see what's going on there. I got to update my site here pretty soon. I certainly will when the new book comes out. But people can go there. They can go to America on Earth. Google that. Go to the H2 website. You can see our site. Watch a couple of free clips that are pretty interesting. And, of course, watch the show. I think you can... I think they have it on YouTube and other places, but you can see the last episode on our website, and the new season will probably kick off around Thanksgiving, and the ratings have been really good. We've been contacted by thousands of people who have got some very interesting things. There's all kinds of mysteries here on this continent that will dovetail with other parts of the world. Obviously, we're all connected in various ways throughout time. And I'm just thrilled to be able to get out there and bring this information to people and learn myself. It's just an amazing experience.
Well, very good. There you have it, guys. Thank you, Scott Volter, for coming on the program. We appreciate it. Good having you back again, and keep up the good work, and we'll keep monitoring. And maybe at some point we can have you back and talk more about all this stuff, of course, because there's much more to it.
Absolutely, and I really appreciate the opportunity here, Henrik, and anytime, give me a call, we'll definitely get together again.
We have some great programs coming up with Franco Collins from Eucadia next. After this, we have Anthony Gucciardi, and then a roundtable with Lloyd Pye, Brian Forrester, and Jerry Willis. Thank you for listening, glad to have you with us, thank you so much. Also, of course, sign up for a membership if you haven't already, and enjoy the full archives. Have a good day, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.